Good morning. This is the we'll do this as a subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Ways and Means General Government. And this morning we're hearing on Senate Bill 5528. We'll open a hearing relative to the legislative branch agencies. And we welcome President Courtney to be with us today. Thank you very much for dignifying us with your presence, President Courtney. With that, we're going to go ahead and hear from our legislative fiscal office representatives, Larry Neiswander, and we recognize Karen Segrist, our committee assistant this morning. Larry?
Good morning, committee members. At least before you pack it, just to give you an overview of the legislative branch agencies, all six of those, if time permits, will give you some overview statements today and part of the public hearing process. I would want you to note that on the agenda at 10:30, we do need to work session a public employees retirement system bill so that it can be on the full agenda for later today. So we'll probably have to interrupt wherever we are at that point to take that bill up. Briefly, in the memo, first if I could start and walk you through that a little bit. There were no, attached to the back of it is the LFO analysis of the ledge branch agencies for you to read, review, and probably something, there may be things in there that you will want to pick up on relative to the testimony that's being provided, but it summarizes for you, as is with other agencies, each agency's description, their revenue sources, what's going on in their budget environment, and what is in their agency request budget. As far as budget notes, there were no budget notes for any of the legislative branch agencies in the 0103 session. There were emergency board appearances, five in total, three of them by legislative administration, and you can see a summary of what those activities were in the memo. These involved other funds requests, with one exception for ledge administration, where in the last e-board before session, there was approximately $290,000 appropriated for to partially restore some funding for committee administrators and committee assistants. In other respects, they were other funds expenditure limitation, primarily related to the hearing room remodel and other funds limitation for facility maintenance operating funds so that they could use those funds to cover costs on a one-time basis for custodial staff and building coordinators. Legislative Council had the only other appearance before emergency board, and they had two appearances. One was to get other funds limitation. This is the first biennium where the agency has been set up to charge for bill drafting services, and that by providing them that other funds limitation, they're able to use that revenue to offset the costs of providing those services to state agencies. And then the second one was right before session started, where there was funds provided to restore their ability to purchase replacement computers. The second page of the memo summarizes for you, as you do with other agencies, some of the budget drivers that relate to these agencies, and they're in bulleted form there. In essence, these agencies' workload are driven primarily by session, fiscal policy and committees, the bills drafted and amended, and in ledge administration's budget is largely driven by building maintenance, repair, operation costs of the facility, and committee staff services. Of late, though, there has been also been increased demand for security, and you'll hear more about that today. As far as major issues before you relative to these agencies, since it is a legislative branch budget, the executive branch doesn't exercise budgetary control over that, so they do not come in with a detailed recommendation for a governor's recommended budget. What the governor's budget proposes to do with the legislative branch is funded essentially at the 0103 legislatively approved level after the fifth special session, which is approximately $55 million. So when you see the bullets there, the first bullet in the second page under the major issues, the governor's budget essentially took about $18.8 million from the agency's request budget total, which in effect has the effect of eliminating approximately $9.4 million in policy packages, and then reducing the base budgets for the legislative branch agencies by an additional $9.3 million, as proposed by the governor. Each of the agencies will come before you and briefly describe what they do today. Four of the six agencies have agency request budgets that are essentially just to maintain their ability to provide ongoing services, as was provided in 0103. Two of the agencies do have policy packages that they will talk to you about. If Unless there are any questions.
Are there any questions for Larry before we hear Dave? Dave, please come forward. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know what the piggy bank is for?
I do, and I've got my money here.
Just go ahead with any acronyms you'd like, and the American Cancer Society will collect.
Well, I've got $2, and my understanding is it's a quarter a time, so I figure I've got 8 chances.
Okay. I'm not good with math, but that sounds good.
Okay. Chair Butler, members of the committee, I'm Dave Henderson, the legislative administrator. Legislative administration was created in 1969 and is now codified in ORS 173-710. The committee consists of the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. The Speaker appoints 4 additional House members, and the President appoints 3 additional Senate members to the committee. The Speaker and the President co-chair the committee, and we've had a meeting that we're going to be holding shortly to go over some issues there. The duties of the legislative administrator are spelled out in statute, and I'll just run through those briefly. They are to coordinate administrative operations of the Legislative Assembly in order to ensure a sufficient workflow, to develop standard formats for legislative manuals and interim committee reports, review legislative organization rules and procedures in cooperation with the Legislative Council with the intent of modernizing legislative operations, to conduct a continuing study of possible applications of technological changes, to arrange for and coordinate orientation conferences for members, to study and make recommendations on legislative compensation and working conditions, to control all space and facilities within the state capitol, to direct renovation and repair of the state capitol, exercise continuing supervision, coordination, and support of clerical and administrative services to the legislative interim committees, perform administrative service functions for the Legislative Assembly, including but not limited to accounting, data processing, personnel administration, printing, supply, space allocation, and property management, provide research facilities and services to members, to print and distribute legislative manuals and interim committee reports, to establish fee schedules for legislative measures, calendars, indexes, and digests, and to coordinate the use of legislative supplies, materials, equipment, and other property. Legislative administration performs these functions through the administrator's office and 5 functional units, and I'll give you a brief description of those units. In the administrator's office, provides the strategic guidance for legislative administration. In addition to that, we have a project coordinator who works many of the projects that we do, as well as the legislative liaison and webpage editor who keeps the legislative website current. Also within the administrator's office is the visitor services unit, which conducts all of the tours and provides the Capitol gift shop support. Then I go through these alphabetically because that's the only way I can remember them. It's not in order of importance. But the 5 functional units are committee services, which provides staffing for the substantive committees. Those would be anything other than revenue committees and Ways and Means Committee. Included in committee services is the legislative library. Second is employee services, which provides all of the human resource work for the legislative branch. That includes recruitment, pay and benefits, anything at all that relates to employment with the legislative branch. Facility services is the unit that takes care of the capital, the physical plant. They do that through two organizations within facility services. First is operations and maintenance, which is the staff that that does the any construction work in the Capitol, that does maintenance of the HVAC system and the various systems within the building. And then there's also publications and distribution, which takes care of distributing all of the measures and supplies, and the custodial unit is within publications and distribution as well. After facility services, we have financial services, which provides all of the accounts payable, accounts receivable, budget work, and everything related to financing for the assembly and legislative administration. They also provide some of the support to the fiscal office, the revenue office, and the Commission on Indian Services. Finally is information systems, which provides all of the support for the computer networks and the personal computers that you have in your offices, as well as providing the media support that operates the closed circuit TV system and the technical systems within the hearing room, such as the microphones and the presentation systems. And was that five? Have I got them all?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We have in our budget request this year a number of policy option packages, and we had 15, which were developed before the depth of the fiscal situation facing the state was apparent. We have reviewed that list and have pared it down to what we believe are the three most important option packages. The first one is package number 400, which is within...
They're in the calendar reference here, committee notebooks.
Under which binder tab?
We're looking. Oh, under facility services is package number 400, page 165. Following the events of 9/11, we increased security here in the building through a variety of measures. One of those was to install additional surveillance cameras, and we do have two people who observe and monitor those cameras from 6 a.m. until 6 p.m. We had an other funds request to the e-board at that time that funded these positions. We would like to create two positions that are access monitors. We have revised this package downward from $183,000 down to $118,000. We intend to do that by eliminating the contractual services with ProStar, the guard that you see at the entrance to the underground parking, and install a camera and monitor that via a camera in facility services rather than have the people out there. The gate then would be rolled down. You would access the garage by using your card. Anyone who needs access to the garage who doesn't have a card would call in via the camera. So that package number 400 has been revised down to $118,228.
Dave, I have a question. I think from the standpoint of security, and I've watched the gate and I've watched this, and you talked about monitoring. You said that it's from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. And the concern I think that some of us expressed in some of your committee hearings was those evenings when legislators were having to stay here late, which would be beyond the 6 p.m. Period. Is there somebody to monitor those cancels then when you're down in the garage? During the day, I don't think it poses a problem as it does with individuals who are in this building at night.
Chair Butler, Senator Winters, there is no provision for staffing those cameras after hours.
Senator Winters?
Yeah, I guess if I look at the security issue, the day doesn't pose as much risk or problems as it does in the late evening. As for me as a legislator, if I'm staying here till 9, you know, sometimes we have meetings in this building till late in the evenings, and you know, you're going down in the garage late, and someone can come through, not through the gated area, but through the other area.
Dave, you do have DPU here as long as there are other meetings going on, right?
Chair Butler, that's correct. Actually, DPU provides the security to the governor's office. The Capitol Mall Patrol Office provides security to the rest of the building, and there are state police on site as long as there are meetings taking place.
So, Senator Winters, your concern is access in the garage at that point, or is it throughout the building?
No, it's the garage area, not throughout the building.
But the elevators are turned off at that particular point.
No elevators are on.
No, the elevators are not turned off until I don't know the specific time, but I believe they're not turned off until all activities, all committee meetings have concluded, and they'll wait half an hour, an hour after that before the meeting goes down.
Representative Patridge is recognized.
Thanks. Dave, is there a reason why we don't just do an all-camera kind of security system then and utilize some of the money that we use for capital security or the state police or I don't know what you call it, instead of having so many state police officers run around here that we just do a camera monitoring, that we beef up the cameras, do a camera monitoring system and utilize that out of there, the access to the garage, and put up more cameras in the building. I mean, that's what I think a lot of office buildings that I've been involved with do, as opposed, I mean, they don't have the same security issues that we do. I know we still have to have capital security people, and I would not want to totally just get rid of those people in full, because if we do have a problem, we need to have some people here to respond. But by the same token, do we need this extra policy package, or are we better off to put in a technology piece and shift some of the capital security money?
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, what this package does is gives us the ability to hire the people to monitor the cameras. We have a number of cameras already, and this gives us the ability to do that. What we've got with the state police is a contract to provide the security in the building, and they do beef that up during session so that we've got right. enough people around so that we can have somebody in each hearing room should there be anything going on that requires having somebody there.
But I guess my question is, what do we do? You know, most of us are used to it during the session. Most of the members are used to it during the session, and maybe when we're in town on hearings. But, I mean, what's your staffing look like in the building during the interim?
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, the staffing in the interim in the state police is not very significant. We have the lieutenant, the sergeant, and a couple of troopers who are here, and they're working all the different shifts. So there's not a lot of security, not a lot of state police in the building during the interim.
Senator Winters?
I guess I would... I'm going to piggyback on the monitoring issue, because it seems to me we've got coverage from 7 in the morning to 6 p.m. And during session, you know, often we're here until 9 and 10 o'clock at night. And I guess my concern is that 9, 10 o'clock at night, particularly individuals like myself having to go down in the garage when the garage is basically empty. And I think, you know, those are where you really need to make sure that you're safe down there. I know Senator Cardin's being quiet, but I know he had raised that issue when we had talked about it in your committee, when we talked about the security issue and whether or not we're covering individuals, you know, in those late hours. And there's nothing in this building to prevent anyone from coming down in the garage. You can access so many ways in getting downstairs without coming through the gates.
Chair Butler, Senator Winters, I want to be clear. We do have state police in the building as long as there are committee meetings going on. So it's not unprotected at that point. But the cost of maintaining more extensive state police presence in the building is pretty high.
Yeah, the concern that I would have in that regard, Senator, and let me see if this might address it, is that if you are completing a committee meeting at 9 o'clock and not leaving until 9:30, you're concerned that there is no one monitoring any of the cameras in the garage. But let me ask this, Dave. Those folks are wrapping up at 9:30 with the committee hearing at that particular point. Are some of those available to go ahead and make sure that legislators' automobiles are overseen as they're going and getting into their automobiles and leaving, exiting the building?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Would they be available after they're leaving a hearing room? Would they be available to go ahead and monitor the garage as people are leaving?
Chair Butler, the people monitoring are in the facility services office. They're not state police.
I'm using the word monitoring incorrectly. I don't mean to indicate that they would need to go in and monitor the cameras,
mm-hmm.
but actually physically be present in the garage at some point, because I understand there has been some vandalism and some theft in the garage, whether that's during hours or after hours.
I wasn't aware of any theft, but our custodial staff who are working at that time are always available to escort anyone out. If you can just grab a custodian, they're happy to do that, or any of the state police who are here.
I guess, you know, you're talking two positions, and I don't see why you can't stagger two positions. You've got a lot more staff here during the day than you do here at night. And without even adding any additional costs, it just seems to me that the deployment of staff could be made certain, if you're just talking about monitoring those cameras, and if cameras are downstairs in the basement, that that's a good utilization of staff time. And just kind of making sure that you're covering that period of time in camera monitoring. Because it is, you know, a little disquieting. You know, I'm not as brawny as you guys are. I might pack a wallet or two, but I don't think I think if I got in a tussle down there, it would be very difficult. And I can remember in these days when you had huge issues in this building, it wasn't beyond having Posse Comitatus and others coming down in that garage. And so, you know, that can be very unnerving for individuals that you have somebody that you're having to handle. And for me, I think it's a good security measure.
Let me ask this relative to that then. Recognizing that you do have rather substantial amounts of staff that are arriving at the end of the workday, and that those folks are doing lots of other things in the building, which includes not only on the regular operations floors, but also down in the garage, are those folks trained or encouraged to monitor any of the activities in the garage as they're coming and going in their work duties?
Yes, Chair Butler, they are encouraged to.
That might be able to respond to some of the concerns that Senator Winters has expressed, but I'm anxious that we won't be able to provide, I'm anxious that we won't be able to provide 100% of the support that some folks would feel like that we'd ought to, but I'm also anxious that if we demand absolute and total security, there's just no way that we're going to be able to provide that. And even if we had resources to add the additional positions, including those that are included here on package 400, that any false sense of security that we might get out of someone watching a camera, we need to be very cautious about that. And recognize how far we've come in 4 years. In 4 years, we had the garage door, 4 years ago, we had the garage doors left open 24 hours, unmonitored. That there weren't anyone here in the building to monitor folks coming and going or staying overnight in the basement. So we've, and of course I recognize that, you know, certainly circumstances have changed and we've been involved in other activities since then.
I'm not asking for additional staff. I think you can just take and do a different utilization of staff.
Okay, Senator. Representative Patrick.
But I guess my question is, Dave, how much of the building is really covered by cameras now? Does it make sense on the monitor? I mean, it's great to give you guys two positions, but I don't know. I don't even know what area. I mean, do we have? Maybe I need to know the where the monitoring station is and what we actually have coverage of in the Capitol, and maybe I can tour that one day or whatever we got going on. My concern is we hire two people, but we don't even have all the cameras in place. I don't know what we have available in the garage. I don't know what we have available throughout the building. And this isn't just a session thing. We have a lot of staff and employees and other people who work late during the you know, all during the interim when we're not even here. We're at home back in our districts, and their safety and security is an important issue too. You know, it's as equally important as protecting members in my mind, and so I guess that's my concern. Is I don't want to give two staff people and not understand the scope of really what's getting monitored.
Sure, Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, I'd be happy to take you around and show you. And for obvious reasons, we'd rather not discuss too publicly what we do have. It would minimize the effectiveness of it to do so, but I'd be happy to show you around.
Dave, will you take some time?
I don't know if it would minimize the effectiveness of it. Might be better off to publish that to the public, that you're monitoring in the Capitol all over the place, too. I mean, I think that there's a certain deterrence factor there too. We don't want to show people where the dark spots are, obviously. But
would you get together with Representative Patridge privately following committee and make sure he has a healthy understanding of what that is? I also would like to talk to you about what kind of recording devices there are on your cameras that are kept for any period of time, so that we'll have a feeling of what kind of tracks and traces we're leaving in the building. So it, maybe we could meet that. So we've received then package 400. Your second package, Dave, you mentioned there was a couple of them.
Second package is package number 300, and you will find that in your book behind the information systems tab on page 123. Actually, let me back up, make that page 122. 10 years ago, the Legislative Assembly directed the legislative administrator to look into updating the technology that is used for scheduling committee hearings, for drafting legislative measures, for keeping track of the workflow of bills through the process. And 4 years ago, we actually started on what has been named the Technology Transition Project. During the interim following the 99 session, we moved the committee agenda scheduling system off of the mainframe. During the interim following the 2001 session, we moved the desk processes for the Secretary of the Senate and the Chief Clerk of the House off of the mainframe. And the next phase in this project is to move measure drafting off of the mainframe. This package, which was just under $2.3 million, we've reviewed it and found some savings, and we've revised it down to $2.1 million. And this would allow us to complete the migration off of the mainframe. Our mainframe, the hardware is fine. It's the software that is the problem, quite frankly. It's very old and is no longer supported by IBM. So our concern is that if we do not proceed with this, we will run into a situation where there's a fix that can't be found due to the lack of people who have the programming knowledge in the language that system is currently working.
Dave, my concern is that when you start talking about migrating away from the mainframe out to individual platforms in other locations, and I'm not technically savvy in that regard, my concern is that as you continue to move away from the mainframe so that you will have better access to your programs and the ability to run those programs at a different level, that sounds like a devolution that we're trying to do that because of problems in our programming, and that we're moving away from some consolidation. Representative Patridge will be working on issues dealing with information technology. My concern is that sounds like we're moving in the wrong direction here, Dave. Can you address that, please?
Chair Butler, what we're doing is moving off of proprietary software that requires us to work within the IBM environment and into a situation where we would have greater flexibility as far as developing the programs and the applications for our own use. So we would not be tied to software that we didn't have the ability to alter, to change, to adapt without going through IBM. So this is going to give us greater flexibility and less reliance on a single individual system.
Representative Patches, you've got an opportunity to briefly examine the purpose of that policy option package.
I think, Mr. Chair, this is the one that we looked at this last legislative, during the last legislative session. They're migrating to off-the-shelf packages as opposed to proprietary packaging, which is kind of what we wanted to do in terms of where we were at and our ability to recruit and retain staff, as well as deal with a lot more flexible database kind of system. Oracle is, I think, still the number one database system in the world right now for database engine. And I think there was some question about whether Sun was the right platform or not, but that's beyond my level of expertise. as well, because Oracle can run on a lot of different platforms. But I think that was an issue.
Okay.
I'd be happy to look more at this too, though. But anyway,
this policy action package is presented with net savings, so the total general fund $2.1 million. Please continue, Dave.
Our third option package is package number 301, and that's just one page further in your book on page 125. The entire package is for $329,382 for ongoing licensing and support. We have reviewed this package as well as the others, and the actual cost for the licenses that we must renew is $160,000, so we've revised it down to that level. And that's a cost of doing business. If we don't have that, we will not be paying our licensing agreements on the software that we're operating.
These are the individual licenses for each of the pieces of software, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, correct.
Why aren't those charged to the members specifically as members' accounts?
Chair Butler, it's always been done through our budget. We've never done it. We've never doled that out to individual members.
Okay. All right. And that's $329,382.
Revised down to $160,000.
What did you eliminate?
Chair Butler, Senator Winters, I would be happy to read through this and tell you exactly what we did and consult with my IS staff. I just know that the baseline of what we need for licensing is $160,000. There were some other things that were rolled into that package.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
And let's see. Okay, fine. Thank you very much, Dave. Are there questions, further questions for Mr. Henderson?
I just want to be clear, Mr. Chair. Those were the three packages in excess of the governor's budget that you guys felt were necessary in order to perform the basic functions of the legislature.
Correct.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
What was the combination of those three packages, Dave? What was the total?
Approximately $2.4 million.
Net of $2.4 million by the time everything's
done. Yeah, this is what he has spoke to are three of the 14 packages they've prioritized. He didn't address the other 11. In total, the packages were originally approximately $9.3 million. So,
oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So the three that he prioritized are approximately $2.4
million. Okay. Well,
the only thing I would add to the technology package discussion is that right now, in order for them to complete the technology transition package, they're having to run dual systems and maintain those, and so there's some ongoing costs that I think are attributable to that, and would even if you didn't do this package, I think there's some costs that when you do it, you're not going to have to continue to run the second system, if you will, maintaining a parallel system. So completing the transition package, I think there's approximately $200,000 or $300,000 that I'm aware of that they're spending just to keep this other system running until this is done. That would be freed up in subsequent biennium.
Are there FTE savings? I mean, is there any FTE savings through IT on the transition piece, Dave? If we're able to fund package 300? I mean, it's a totally different system, totally different set of applications and tools. What's the staff transition training piece going to look like?
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, if I'm understanding your question, can you elaborate?
Well, you have a whole suite of programmers that are
right
up there for,
right,
for the current mainframe that are available. The new system, moving to an Oracle database with a Sun, operating on a Sun platform, is a totally different set of tools. While some of the applications may be good, it's also a faster system. I understand there's going to be some ramp-up time, but ultimately when we transition, hopefully you're not going to have to support the same amount. You won't need the same staff support that you currently need for is there an attrition plan that you guys have, or you plan on keeping the same amount of programmers?
We have not looked beyond
specifically beyond the next about 2.5 years that would be developing the bill drafting system and moving it off. I don't know that we would be at a point where we would go through any reductions at that time, because we have ongoing support for the systems that we've launched in the last 4 years. Potentially there could be some reductions at that point, but I don't know if.
I'd just like to know the answer to that as we look out towards
it. I'd be happy to check on that.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Did you want to spend some time now on the Legislative Assembly budget, Dave?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I can do that.
I'm sorry. Senator?
Where do you get in? Where do you get $2.1 million? Is that just, you deal with that differently in terms of where he's going to get the $2.1 million to complete this off-mainframe?
We bring a magical hat in and tap it 3 times, Mr. Chair, Mayor, Senator, President Courtney. Actually, at this point, it's up for discussion, but do you have a suggestion?
Chair Butler, President Courtney, we've developed a list, as other agencies have, of a reduction list that we would go through. And we would work our way down that list. We would have to prioritize items on that list against the technology transition and make decisions at that point as to whether we would make those other reductions to fund technology transition. And that's a policy decision that the legislature will have to make.
Have you prioritized these 3 policy option packages higher than some of the other basic functions that you're presently functioning under?
Chair Butler, yes. We've got items in our budget request that, because of circumstances, we no longer need. And if we were to be, for instance, flat-funded, we've got $1.7 million, I think, in our budget request that is for debt service that we don't need.
I see that.
So if we give that up, and if we could buy something on this list, we would like to do that.
Senator Courtney?
Well, I don't want to this much further, but it's my understanding that in part, if not totally, this is going to be funded by a reduction in committee administrators to other committees in the building. And I didn't know how that's gotten into here. I guess what's gotten into is that you have these documents and that's dealt with in some other way, because that is a significant policy decision to reduce the staff for the committee administrators for other committees in this building in order to fund this $2.1 million. So I guess that discussion will be taking place in this room or in some other way or some other time.
Senator Courtney, it certainly will be discussed, and usually we allow Legislative Fiscal Office to put their 2 cents in on that, usually not at this time, but I think it's probably appropriate.
Okay. And it doesn't need to be done. As long as I really am curious to know what that this committee can use, Chair, and the other members feel about that. And I assume you'll be made aware of that along the line, since apparently we're not going to do it in front of the Legislative Administration Committee. This is the committee of choice and jurisdiction that will be dealing with that. And I would hope that you'll make some decision on that or give us some input as to your feelings about that kind of policy decision.
Certainly, absolutely, and that'll be worked through with the co-chairs, and you'll be kept abreast of that, President Courtney, as well. Larry?
Yes, just to address the Senate President's comments, attached to the back of the packet that I gave you was each of the agencies were asked to put together a prioritized list of reductions, and each attached to the very back of that packet was a 30% reduction list for each agency. Did you not get that, Senator?
No, I'm fully aware.
Okay. In any event, what Senator President would be referring to is if there were decisions made to make reductions to self-fund these packages, the prioritized list would be a source for the committee to go to, as well as the co-chairs and the speaker and the president. And on those prioritized lists, they do identify some of the reductions Dave has referenced. If, in fact, that policy decision is made to make reductions to self-fund, or if the reductions are made for purposes of otherwise meeting the budget plan. But in public hearing today, we weren't necessarily going to go over those in great detail. There hasn't been, unless that's what the committee wants to spend some time on, but those lists were attached for your reference. Each of the agencies were required, as were executive branch agencies, to come up with 30% reduction lists in prioritized order.
And we do have that reductions list, and if it is the decision that we will go ahead and select some of the policy options, and if those policy option packages are in fact more important than others of the regular functions that are funded under the current budget arrangement, then certainly those are some of the choices that will be made.
Jim, I just want to be sure, I'm sure the committee understands just the Ways and Means process has their staff, very good staff. The other committees out there have committee administrators staff, which are critically important too. And it's my understanding you can't generate $2.1 million unless you go after the staff, at least in part or total, for these other committees, both during the general, perhaps even during the interim. So that's the only point I'm just going to make, bring to your attention. I realize the measure drafting is critical to all of us, but I have been led to believe that perhaps we could live with that for another 2 years. But I am really curious to know how this committee, which is the Supreme Being Committee in terms of its view of this, feels about these different decisions.
Thank you very much, President. And we'll normally we'll work that through, but I do recognize that amongst the priorities list of the savings that are being offered up includes some of the committee services that are about $1.6 million. Between that 1.6 that's being considered there and the 10.71 FTE that are being provided there, and the other efficiencies that are potential, that we'll very carefully consider those in consultation with the President, yourself as President, with our Speaker, and the co-chairs to make certain that we address those in a prioritized fashion.
Thank you, Chair Butler.
Thank you very much, President Cornyn. David?
The Legislative Assembly exists in, obviously, the Oregon Constitution, and the structure of the operations of the Assembly is in ORS Chapter 171. The budget that has been submitted funds at a level to maintain ongoing activities the operations of the offices of the 90 legislators, the 6 leadership offices, the Secretary of the Senate, and the Chief Clerk of the House. That pretty much sums it up, Mr. Chair.
That's
there are no proposed option packages in the Assembly budget.
Okay. President Cornyn?
Again, I'm really hopeful, relying on your input in things like the House Lounge, Senate Lounge, as well as the staff during the winter. I say that because I've accidentally found out in this position I'm in that I guess it's historic that the President and the Speaker get together and they do a lot of this, but I don't feel confident doing it unless I get significant input, for example, from you folks right here. So I hope you will. Maybe you do that anyway, Chair Butler, and members of the committee. I'm not trying to insult you, but it's something that I feel very strongly about. The kind of input that hasn't happened in the past, I want to start to happen. And so I come to you and beg you to tell us what you think in terms of some of these key areas, if you would, please.
Thank you, President Cornyn. And we appreciate your invitation to allow that kind of input and expressions of concern. And my angst is that we do have a list of the prioritized items, and there will be some cuts to general funds as we go through. I think that the legislature has demonstrated its willingness relative to the Assembly in this particular regard, as we're discussing that, has demonstrated some willingness to go ahead and make cuts. And I want to make sure that we absolutely honor those. The need to generate the savings within the Assembly, as well as all of the other legislative administration, legislative branch agencies. So we do have the priorities list in front of us, and that will be an item that we will need to prioritize as well. So,
Chair Butler, the one point I would make relative to that is the items on that list for the Legislative Assembly are in no priority order. Those priority decisions, either this committee or this committee consulting with the leaders, get to make those decisions. Those are merely listed in an order that they just came out. That is not a priority list. Those are options that are available to you. There could be other options that could be developed as well.
And do you see amongst the top 10% of those items, Dave, do you see still the ability of the assembly's budget, legislative assembly's budget, to provide for the needs of what its mandated responsibilities are, the Constitution mandated.
Chair Butler, that's a, I'm going to defer to you and the members of your committee. That's a policy decision for you to make.
Okay, I guess when I see items on that list of eliminating out-of-state travel from the travel budgets and those kinds of things, I look at that and say that might be the important thing for us to do to demonstrate that we can go ahead and continue to live within our resources, and where maybe there have been funds set up for some of these kinds of things in the past, maybe we, in a time of budget crisis, need to make those hard choices. So, but also I see that, you know, the elimination of staff, what I'm concerned about is I think that you can comply with the, that the assembly can comply with its legislatively and constitutionally mandated responsibilities by not traveling out of state. The concern I've got is can we, by eliminating 28.8 staff in the interim at a savings of $4.13 million, or the session secretaries to the members for $1.6 million at 22.5, can we still function with our constitutional mandates? That's the question that we'll have to have you assist us with when we come to that particular point.
And Chair Butler, the difficulty in the assembly budget, quite frankly, is it is all in people. So to get to 30%, you've got to cut people. And I would agree with you. I don't see how you could do your job and function without support of that staff that you pointed out.
Senator Winters?
Well, it would be helpful, thank you, Mr. Chair, if there was some narrative. I know when in my committees that we asked them to do the priority rankings, we also asked them to give us a description of its impact and its implication, and it would be well to have, you know, from our own staff to give us the impacts and those implications. What does it mean if you remove security? What does it mean if, you know, with some of these, we can make some assumptions, but it would be well to know what the implications really are.
Thank you. Larry?
Yes, just part of the reason that this is, I think the Senate President's brought this up too, is that in the governor's proposed funding level for the legislative branch, it would, if you took it on a pro rata share basis, the assembly's share of that reduction of about, after policy packages, would be approximately $4 million. So if, without additional funding above the governor's proposed level, the assembly budget could have to go well into the reductions list that's before you. And so prioritizing that is an important part of this, as well as determining the funding level that we're going to have the branch live within.
Colleagues, that $4 million cut, are areas that we haven't been necessarily prioritizing in the past. And so, as the Senate President has indicated, we may need to make some hard choices within this committee, and I think we have the ability to do it. Representative Patridge?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed the Senate President's talk on this, but, you know, I view the legislative assembly budget as the same I view. Same way I view the court's budget, we have a constitutional system to balance, and we need to be able to maintain some level of oversight, discretion, and ability for the legislature to do its job to fundamentally function to the extent of the people. So I'm willing to go elsewhere to look for other things in order to maintain a semblance of order and our ability to do our job to provide the policy direction for the state of Oregon. So I guess that's how I look at the legislative, a lot of these legislative budgets and the court budgets. I think those are core government functions that fundamentally need to continue to function. If we can find fat in it, let's find the fat in it. But frankly, I'm concerned that even at our current level of funding, whether we can do our job as effectively as we need to do for the citizens of the state of Oregon in addressing the major policy issues and changes that occur on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, I'm not going to be one who wants to go down the path to, you know, to hamstring the legislative assembly so that it can't do its job and effectively function for the people.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative Patridge, and there are options that are thrown in here. And I know that it's always a 4 years ago we got into this and made some policy option choices. to go ahead and make some administrative cuts within the some of the policy analysts, as I recall. And what ended up happening was that the those policy analysts, I think, were subsequently added back by in the Christmas tree package before we got clear to the end, because there were some folks that were anxious that all of those folks be available as policy analysts for the president's office and for the speaker's office when it was all done. So. Representative Johnson recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to put a finer point on Representative or Senator Winter's request to have some indication of what the impact of this is. In just looking at the line items, it's very difficult to tell, for example, membership dues in the Northwest Economic Region. Having no idea of the impact of foregoing association membership at that level of funding, I don't know what that would, what abilities that would deprive the Assembly of.
And Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, the one thing I can tell you about that specific item is that that's not budgeted right now. There's money in the budget, line item money in the budget for NCSL dues and CSG dues, but some of those other items, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region is not funded, the multi-state highway use agreement is not funded, so those are items that are paid for out of savings in other portions of the budget as it is.
Thank you.
Okay. And and so those NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislators, the Council of State Governments, Northwest Economic Region, those are already drawn out. That's about $2 million.
Actually, if I could clarify, there's a little bit of the way it's formatted, hard to read. The $1.524 million relates to the signee die line above it.
If
the session ended by July 7th, that's a best estimate of what the carryover amount from the Assembly's budget would be into the next interim. Below that is the estimated cost savings if you eliminate the membership dues of $412,716. And that's not necessarily based on how those are line item budgeted, but based on previous experience and the expenditures that have been spent toward those things that would in fact come out of.
And it's all of those things in the aggregate.
That would be all of those things.
Thank you. I didn't understand that until you explained it.
But those are presently not already are not already budgeted.
Well, let's just say that the costs attributable to those have been paid for out of the current service budget, and would in fact this would be the amount that you would reduce if you were saying if you've afforded that in the past and you no longer wish to pay for it in the next biennium, that would be the approximate savings.
And would be a savings to the general fund.
Correct.
Okay. All righty. Other questions relative to the Legislative Assembly budget? Thank you very much, Dave. Appreciate
it. And on the assumption that I used an acronym or two in there, I'll donate.
I think between NCSL and a couple of others, I'm guilty of it here, too. So
that's
our Representative Johnson is my banker in this committee. She'll keep track of how much I owe them.
You're the chair. You're allowed that.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Greg Chemoff, Legislative Council. And Dave, could we have you get back with us on the House Bill 3182, at least the 10% priority, together then with the remaining 20% to make up 30%, because we really need to prioritize that first 10%.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Welcome, Greg. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chemoff, Legislative Council, good morning. I'm going to start out today by discussing the agency's mission, the tasks that you have assigned to our office, to discuss the agency's staffing and organization, our major budget and organizational events, then the budgeting process, cost control, and needs, and then finally the major budget issues facing the office. Our mission, as you have defined it in statute, is to draft measures and amendments for members and committees of the Legislative Assembly and for the agencies and officers of the other branches of government. 75% of our budget is general funded, and that covers in large part the drafting work that we do to prepare you for your sessions. In that process, we also engross and enroll your measures. We prepare the weekly index to legislative measures that accumulates throughout the session. We provide legal advice to members and committees of the Legislative Assembly. We prepare the advance sheets of Oregon laws as the laws are filed with the Secretary of State. We publish those also in a hardbound form and distribute those to the public. We publish the Oregon Revised Statutes. That's the plum-colored 19-volume set that Representative Patridge is perusing at the moment. Our publications is intended to be a self-supporting enterprise. We provide the publications at cost so that citizens don't end up paying a premium for their laws. A principal benefit to this office preparing the publications is that it allows us to retain our experienced publication and editorial staff throughout the interim so that they're available for your benefit during the session. In addition to the laws and the statutes, we also produce specialty publications, including the Oregon Criminal Code. This is a volume we sell more than 10,000 of each biennium. We also prepare for a number of agencies the text and indexes of publications that they then produce. This is a copy of the Secretary of State's Manual on Election Laws. That's a document which, along with the Motor Vehicle Code and any number of other publications that other agencies use, we prepare for them but are published under their auspices. We review and report on the validity of all administrative rules adopted by executive department agencies. We review in a biennium roughly 2,000 submissions, and we report our findings on the validity of those rules to the Legislative Council Committee. When directed by the Legislative Council Committee, we represent the interests of the Legislative Assembly in court. There have been two major court actions in the past year. And then finally, when directed by members or a committee, we assist citizens in the drafting of initiative measures. The office is supervised by a committee, the Legislative Council Committee, which consists of members of the Legislative Assembly, including the Speaker and the Senate Democratic and Republican leaders. That committee sets the office's policy and approves major personnel decisions. Our staff consists of, our permanent staff consists of 13 attorneys, 17 non-legal professionals, folks who have advanced degrees and other than the law and substantial experience in editing in the print media. We have five administrative personnel, and we operate also using the half-time, full-time services of a retired attorney, and we have received those services half a day, every day, roughly for the last 20 years. For session and editing help, we normally hire an additional six attorneys and 10 non-legal professionals and some hourly workers to help in the office's administration. The balance of staff in our office, having fewer lawyers and more non-legal professionals, is unusual for legislative drafting offices throughout the country. It's considered to be essentially drafting on the cheap, because the non-legal professionals, at least the outstanding ones that we are able to employ, cost less than lawyers do. As a result, our office has been the model for legislative drafting offices in emerging democracies, including some of the new countries that emerged out of the former Soviet Union. We have exported our entire procedures and, in some cases, personnel to help those countries set up their offices. You'll find our organizational chart on page 51. We are divided into three administrative divisions. There is legal services, which drafts bills and amendments and provides advice. There's publication services, which is also involved in drafting bills and amendments and in publishing the office's books. And then we have administrative services, which works in sales and distribution of the periodicals, in accounting, and for your purposes, means Midge. I'm at the top of the office's hierarchy. We have a Chief Deputy, Joan Robinson, who has been with the Legislative Assembly now for over 20 years. She is, as the Chief Deputy, also the Chief Editor of the Oregon Revised Statutes. We have a manager of our Publication Services section and a manager of our Administrative Services section. Then there are senior staffers, either senior deputies or, if it's not legal work, senior team leaders who provide supervision and mentoring to the less experienced staff. Over the years, we have been embarked in an effort to have an office that is run with fewer bodies and bigger brains. In the past, the office had fewer continuing staff members and more in the way of session staff. It was our observation that that kind of turnover wasted the expense of training and the expense of experience. Was also our observation that experience is a commodity in our line of work that is very difficult to find enough money to pay for. As a result, as the opportunity arises, we have been combining numbers of session positions into a smaller number of continuing staff positions, and we believe that that is enabling us to build a more experienced office and to provide you with better service. Part of the reason for the need to do that is 5 years ago, the office lost roughly two-thirds of its institutional memory. Since then, three more employees with over 20 years' experience have left the office, and we have, over the past 5 years, been in the process of staffing the office back up. This is the first time in my tenure in which, for example, all of the drafters in the office have at least one prior session experience.
Greg, current status with regard to the PERS, you have some of those employees that may jump with regard to the opportunities that may afford themselves right now?
Mr. Chair, I don't expect that to happen, no. I think that the public employee benefits may have been a substantial factor in the rather significant retirements that occurred about 5 years ago, but I don't believe that any of that played a factor since then or is likely to in the near future. We have in the past while consolidated and improved our sales. We have moved all of our inventory, sales and shipping from multiple off-site locations to one. We have streamlined the procedures, eliminating some steps in the process. We have also obtained more advanced software that allows us to spend less time devoted to the processing of requests. We are faster in that work and also faster for our customers. We have instituted some work quality improvements, including a peer review process, which, except during the particular heat of session, drafters provide drafts of their work to more senior members of the office for review and comment to ensure that we're providing you with the best possible work. I also review all opinions before they leave the office to make sure that we're providing you with clear and consistent advice. We have had some technological advancements over the past few years. The legislative administration has provided us with an electronic docket that has replaced the paper docket that we used, which speeds our ability to find files and to provide you with reports on the status of your work. Legislative administration is working on providing us with a system to replace our 30-year-old indexing system, which is currently housed on a computer at the Department of Administrative Services. Measure drafting system, which runs on legislative administration's mainframe, is roughly 20 years old, and that was part of the systems that Mr. Henderson talked to you about being part of his technology transition program.
Greg, in as much as the legislative council is the primary beneficiary of policy option package 300 for technology transition, how does that directly affect your office and your ability to function?
Mr. Chair, from time to time, there is a short delay when a legislative administration has to scramble to find the rare resources available to maintain our drafting system. If you want to imagine our drafting system as being the equivalent of a very fine vintage automobile, but one when a part breaks down, it's difficult to find a replacement. Can we survive for another couple of years with this system? Yes. Would we provide better service to you with a newer, updated system that was actually graphic-based instead of entirely text? Yes. Our drafting system is very powerful, but it's very slow, and we can continue, I would hope, without any change in quality or quantity or speed of service without a new drafting system. But at some point, and I don't know when that point's going to be, our vintage automobile is simply going to be too old to keep on the road anymore.
Representative Patridge?
Greg, where's the printing for all of our bill printing? And maybe this is not in your budget, I don't believe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, the printing is almost always done at the state printer and is either part of the Legislative Assembly's budget or Legislative Administration's. We do provide some printing, but it's a small part compared to the others.
I mean, I know where their publications are printed. I guess I'd like to know where we're at on a printing basis. Legislative Council, a lot of people have. I mean, we use so much money in printing, and maybe Dave wants to address that. I mean,
Dave,
I'm just trying to
go ahead and do that.
I mean, most of Greg's stuff is transferred electronically to the state printer now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, entirely.
And I mean, if we're looking for money for cost, there's nothing on here about changing printing. And I don't. And while Greg's here and Dave's here, I don't know what our. I was trying to look constitutionally and statutorily. I don't know what our requirements are for printing, but I mean, it's a huge number.
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, I don't know that it's set in statute how many we print, and we are constantly reviewing that and trying to reduce the amount that we print because so much of it goes straight into recycling. It is part of the Legislative Assembly budget.
How much did we, I mean, do we have an idea of what we spend every biennium on printing?
We will in just a moment.
All right.
Some of that probably is pushed through the Department of Administrative Services printing budget as well.
$600,000.
That's it? $600,000 is in? Okay.
The balance probably goes through the Department of Administrative Services in their print shop, is that right? In their budget?
Mr. Chair, it's all ours.
Is it?
Yeah, okay. It's all yours. It's all the Legislative Assembly.
Is there an assessment back then from the Department of Administrative Services and their print plant? We pay for it.
We pay for it, yes.
It's directly charged here?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll keep that in mind when we see their budget, too. Okay. Please continue, Greg.
Thank you. In the preparation of the budget, I asked everybody in the office what they need to keep doing their jobs well and what they need to improve the jobs they're doing. The kind of answers that I get are, we waste time at the copy machine because it breaks down and we need a new one. And when that happens, we come to you and ask for the funds for a new one. I approve every expenditure the office makes. I investigate every unusual expenditure. If computer research for a month jumps 20%, I review who's doing the research, go and track them down, find out why their research has cost more, discover it's Representative Patridge wanting to know what the lien laws of the various 50 states are, and then we explore means to see if we can find that information less expensively. There is, to the best of my knowledge, no fraud, waste, or abuse to cut in our budget. All of our activities are required by law, and any reduction in the funds available to the office will cause a direct response in our ability to provide you with the services to which you have been used to receiving. I realize that option packages are disfavored. Most of the option packages included with our budget are ways to make our service better for you. One option package, which is number 210, is on pages 78 to 79.
I don't think we have your budget folder, so that's something that did not get passed out.
Oh, well, you're welcome to mine.
Well, we have two then, yours and LFO's. So.
Thank you.
So policy option number?
That is policy option number 210. It is not only, in our view, a good idea, but legally required. This is a package that would allow us to reclassify some of the positions in the office so that they are more highly remunerated. The law requires employees that receive that do comparable work to others to receive comparable pay. And there are employees in the office whose pay is lower than those in other agencies in the executive branch and in this branch, even though they are doing essentially the same work. We had the positions reviewed by Mr. Henderson's staff so that it was not just our evaluation of those positions, and the package reflects his office's analysis of the level at which the people ought to be compensated. These tend to be the more senior people in our office, and I provided Mr. Nyswender with a memorandum that I provided earlier this session to the members of the Legislative Council Committee. You may recall that a few months ago the Oregonian ran a story in which the bottom line was that public employees make essentially the same amount of money as employees in the private sector. One conclusion that study reached was that is not the case when comparing professionals in the public sector and the private sector. I compared what the lawyers in our office make adding in the employer's 6% contribution because of the public employee retirement system, compared that to what the average is for attorneys in private sector in this part of the state based upon the Oregon State Bar's most recent survey of economic conditions, and discovered that particularly among the more senior members of the office. They were making less than 60% the average of their private counterparts, and were also making less than the professionals in other public offices. So package 210, which I believe is $122,000, is something that I commend to you as necessary by law, not as something that would simply be good for the office. The major budget issue facing our office, which also ties to this, is the sales of our publications. 75% of our budget is general fund, 25% is funded by the sales of publications. You need our office to publish because the income from the publications allows us to retain staff through the entire two-year cycle. Our publications revenue has been dropping about 10% per biennium, largely, in my view, as a result of the availability of laws for free over the Internet. In addition, West, one of the world's largest publishers, plans to offer a product that will compete with the Oregon Revised Statutes. It's going to be a much fancier product. It will be substantially more expensive, but it will also be a research tool that a certain segment of the lawyering public will like. We have two options. We can continue to produce the Oregon Revised Statutes as they are, which sell for substantially less than any other state's laws because, one, we're efficient, and two, we sell at cost. And we will lose sales to West, likely later requiring an infusion of general funds to allow us to maintain our staffing levels for the 2005 session. We can stop publishing the Oregon Revised Statutes, join forces with West, and have West's more elaborate and expensive product the only one in the market. We are currently working with West and the chairs of our committee to come up with the best possible solution for our office and for the taxpayers of the state, but we don't have a resolution to that issue yet.
That doesn't sound all that great, Dave. I am concerned about policy option package 210. You're telling us it's probably not an option. It's a mandatory issue relative to your remuneration.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Do you have any positions that are vacant at present?
Mr. Chair, we have positions that don't have bodies in them, but we use the funds from those positions. We bundle them together to create opportunities to serve you better. For example, we are operating with fewer staff attorneys this session because we had the opportunity to hire Chris Crane, who is a very experienced drafter, needed little in the way of refreshing to be able to come in and serve you at a substantially higher level than we might have been able to expect from a staff attorney. And to be able to pay Chris anything close to what he's worth, we had to put Chris in one position, and we have to leave others vacant and use that money to be able to pay him. So,
how many vacancies are there, Greg?
I beg your pardon?
How many vacancies are there right now, then?
Yes.
Seven.
Mr. Chair, seven or eight.
That's of a total staff of about 50 and a half? Or?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right, the other policy option packages, is that?
The other policy option packages, um, while nice, we can live without if you leave the rest of our budget alone.
But are there more than just 310?
Mr. Chair, there's option package 320, which has, among other parts, shifting the rent that we pay from partial publication revenues and partial general fund to all general fund in light of the likely significant decline in our publishing revenues. It includes some additional funds for us to be able to keep turning over the equipment that we're rather hard on. We run through a lot in the way of printers and copiers because of the volume of paper that we're putting through for you each time. There's option package 310, which would give us the other funds authority to spend roughly $117,000, which we hope we would receive from billing agencies for providing them drafting services in the 2005 session. But if you would rather that we continue doing that from general funds and not bill agencies, we can certainly go back to doing that the way we used to. There are two other packages, 410 and 420, I believe, which were not part of the initial package. One was to obtain funds to try to retain an additional deputy because the opportunity has arisen for us to hire someone with experience, a very rare event. And two was to give us additional funds to start keeping what will ultimately be a replacement for Midge at the front desk. Midge is likely to retire in a couple of years. She knows more than anybody else in the office, and we can't just put somebody there to start doing what she's doing. We currently have someone working with Midge who shows outstanding skills and an ability to provide you with outstanding service, but she's going to need, just as any member of our office does, some sessions experience before she can provide you the kind of service that you need to do your job as well as you hope to do it.
Greg, I am concerned, though, that basically what I hear is that the budget is going to have to be enhanced by $122,970 just to bring you into the regular remuneration classifications, and that the vacancies have been used basically to backfill as best you can to provide the service. I'm not certain how that all sorts out, but I did want to make sure that I'm understanding that you're not bringing us any good news right now.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to head out onto thin ice in late March and ask this question. Are there any efficiencies, Greg, that you can recommend to the Assembly in terms of overlapping drafting? It came as a surprise to me when I realized how many drafts you guys are doing that have similar themes, and I know that this is fraught with political difficulties, but is there some way that you can advise the legislature in how to make more judicial use of your time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, in terms of duplicative drafting requests, we undertake as rigorous an outreach program as we think we can without being terribly annoying. As new members join the body, we encourage the new members to allow us to share the new member's name with another member who happens to have a substantially similar request for a measure. The form that we encourage members to use contains a box to check if we can share that member's name with another member who has a similar concept. When I receive a request that is substantially similar to another member's request, and I see all requests when they come in, I call the members who have the similar requests and find out whether we can get those members to work together to have just one draft instead of two that are similar. So to, I don't believe that absent an institutional change, there is much more that can be done on that front. There are any number of models that the legislature could employ that would reduce the number of measures that a member or committee could ask to have drafted. As you may recall, House Bill 4000 in the past session proposed such a scheme and met with less than round success. There are some states, I believe it's Connecticut, that has a bipartisan committee that acts as a screen for measure requests, so that if a member wants a draft done, the measure comes to the committee and says, I have this brilliant idea, may I have it drafted, please? And if the committee thinks that the measure is likely to have some benefit, the committee allows the measure to be drafted. In our view, the single most wasteful aspect of our services is in the number of drafts that we produce that members do not end up using. In a typical session, we will draft 4,000, 4,200 measures, of which 3,000 to 3,200 of which will be introduced. That means roughly 1,000 measures that we produce, the members of this body choose not to put into the process. And there is certainly some benefit to the process of a member's seeing how an idea that looked good in concept looks on paper, to know that, well, this is going to be more complicated than people will be able to push or whatever. But it's my observation that we do what I think is too much drafting that is done for the benefit of constituents for whom, at least for purposes of the resources of the body, it might be better if the member said no when the constituent asked to have a measure drafted.
Well, at least a fourth of my ideas are no good. Representative Patrick?
Greg, can you talk about the Law Commission? How much money is budgeted in your budget for the Law Commission?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I believe it's a little over $200,000.
And can you tell the Law Commission doesn't really, I mean, Legislative Council Committee has oversight over the Law Commission?
Mr. Chair, in theory, yes.
But does the Law Commission provide any direct services to Legislative Council?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, no. The Oregon Law Commission is a body that researches anachronisms in the law, ugly places in the law that lack political constituencies, such as identifying the archaic and unwieldy garnishment system and then preparing with our office draft legislation to make that system easier for the participants to use.
Greg, one of the things I'm going to ask that you do is that you work with the Legislative Fiscal Office to make sure that we can keep your staff remunerated and working within class, so that we're able to at least address that issue. I am concerned about that particular aspect. So, and then the other issue is to make sure that with the vacancies we've got, that we're able to find some efficiencies there. I know what you're using those for to assist. What it takes to get the water to the end of the row right now. I appreciate your letter also of March 4th relative to compensation. I'm wondering if there isn't a difference between LC attorneys and other corporate or in-house lawyers. I don't know that you're going to get as much percentage difference, but certainly your LC staff seems to work at a high pitch and a pretty good pace. But the compensation is modest, I'd be the first to admit that. So is there when you talk about Portland Upper Valley, there are folks that work in-house, corporate and in-house attorneys that might work for less. I don't know. But you're still going to end up at about something under the prevailing wage, I'm sure.
I don't know what the comparison would be, Mr. Chair, but I can certainly look into those figures.
But again, I appreciate what you're trying to do there, and it demonstrates that certainly there is a difference between legislative council staff and what may be paid privately in the upper Portland Valley.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might say, as far as looking for efficiencies, when I came to the office 5 years ago, I had the office take me through and train me in every job there is in the office. I've been to the warehouse to see how the materials are transported from pallets to the shipping dock. I have been with the editors to see how they work through taking what the lawyers have done and make it intelligible to regular people. I've covered everything there is to do in the office, and in the past 5 years have managed to streamline everything that could be streamlined until it's of sufficient interest to the body to make the expenditures to update the office's technology. We work as fast and as hard with the resources that you give us as I think is possible. And if there were a way to get the job done for less money or with fewer people or with less experienced people, we would do it.
And I guess my concern there is that we need to address what may happen with policy option package 300 for the technology, how it might be able to benefit you. But when you we're going to go back and go through each of those positions, I can feel a song coming on or something, being down the river or something, having worked every job from here to there. I appreciate that. Are there further questions for Greg? I'm not sure what our schedule is going to permit. We've got, let me make sure I understand from Legislative Fiscal, we've got a full at this morning at what time? 11:30. We've got work session on Senate Bill 258 at 10:30 even time. So, all right. So we'll just continue on. The concern I've got is I will need to have one of the co-chairs in because Senator Devlin is excused for illness. So, Senator, will you be here at 10:30?
I have a constituent need to meet with him. I'll be right back at 10:30.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Greg. I just want to make sure that we're not all going to split here in just a few minutes. So,
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Henderson, I need to clarify one thing on the information that I gave you related to printing. The $600,000 figure is for printing the measures themselves, the House and Senate bills. There's an additional $500,000 in the Assembly budget that funds the indexes, the status reports, and the daily schedules that you get. So it's a total of $1.1
million. 1.1 total. Thank you. Representative Patridge, you had asked that question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to look at, I mean, Dave, we're doing a major technology upgrade. I just want to look at, I mean, I think that we got a lot of waste on our bills, and we're throwing things down. If Greg can take a look at what our physical printing requirements are, if they are statutory, constitutional, or otherwise, I'd be interested in that. But, you know, I think with where we're at electronically, even with the legislature at this point in time, it may make some sense to be able to move, to get some savings to move towards where we're at electronically, and whether we have to put up a couple kiosks in the building or whatever. You know, I don't mind printing out amendments and things for committees, but that can be done at a much cheaper cost. And that's already occurring, and can be, and those numbers probably aren't even in the budget. I mean, those are probably in legislation. Well, I think you got some, but I think the committee administrator's budget probably has a bunch of that photocopying and stuff too. And so, I think those would already be there. But I think we should look at that, Mr. Chair, to see. I know there's been some resistance to doing that in sectors of this building and potentially outside. But I think we're at the point where we should look at that. And I think at the point we're at, we're not going to hurt the public to any extent. We could still make it that people could go downstairs, but we could print off the bills individually instead of running out, I don't know, 3,000 copies or whatever we run out.
900 copies.
900 copies of every single bill, especially when they're 500 plus pages.
And those are issues where, relative to the information technology access, I think members and other folks who have CT access can go ahead and access that and then print off if they feel like it was really mandatory. Thank you very much, Dave.
CT access, Mr. Chair, I think that's a problem.
I believe it is. I don't think anybody has ever bought that yet. So. Thank you very much, Representative. You add that to my bill, and I'll pay it at the end. Or you want it right now?
No, I got it marked down.
Okay.
All right. I'll be back.
Ken, let's see. Where do I know him from? Thank you very much. And we do have legislative fiscals book. I don't know whether that was an intentional oversight to not have somebody's book here or just what. So. Legislative Fiscal. Ken, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm here to give you a very brief overview of the Legislative Fiscal Office budget. The office was created in 1959. Its statutory duties are identified in ORS Chapter 173. We are a nonpartisan, permanent professional support staff to the Assembly. The basic functions that we do are reviewing the governor's budget and making recommendations on the budget, on all agency budgets for the Assembly, review state expenditures, fiscal implications of the organization of functions of the state, and other things that the Assembly directs us to do. We are the staff to the Joint Ways and Means Committee during session. We staff the Emergency Board during the interim. We also staff the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. We also provide services to other interim task forces, special committees, or other work that's directed by the Assembly. For example, in the last session, we were directed to conduct a review of economic development programs in Senate Bill 973. that we did with existing staff. Our organization, we have 17 permanent full-time positions. During session, we typically bring on two rotation analysts, and that's a cooperative venture with agencies that they we ask for people's names to be submitted, and we typically bring on two people. This session, we only have one. Then we have five session support positions, committee assistants and scheduler. Those are paid out of the legislative administration committee budget. This session, because of the tight budget, we only have four people doing jobs of that we've typically had five people doing in the past. So most of the things that we do, you're all very familiar with. We analyze all measures for fiscal impact. We write fiscal impact statements on those bills that we determine are fiscal. We do that for the original bill and amendments. Typically, we do about 1,500 of those during the session. We analyze and make recommendations on emergency board requests. In the past interim, we had over 500 requests that we did, and this went along with all the special session work that we had to do. The number of requests have been growing over time, and on the handout we provided, you can see there was an 18% increase over 9901. We also analyze and make recommendations for the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology issues, and again, we had about over 80 of those last interim. We do program evaluations and audit reviews as directed by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. I have some samples of four or five that we did last interim. The one on Department of Land Conservation and Development, we did a children and families review, Oregon Savings Growth Plan, hearing officer panel, and then we also do the report on liquidated and delinquent accounts receivable every year. Our budget is basically a maintenance budget. We have no policy packages. It reflects a reduction of that RFP payment that was in Senate Bill 973 of $75,000. The budget, as it shows in the governor's budget, is about $4.3 million. All general fund. We have no other funds. About 90% of that is personal services costs because we are just dominated by peoples. Our technology involvement, we have been a part of the technology transition that you've heard from Dave Henderson and Greg Chamoff. We are on the board. We're represented on that. We have benefited from that in various ways. The other project that we're closely tied to is the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System, which I'm sure you've heard of, known as ORBITS, and we're very supportive of that project because of the additional information it provides, and I think you've been seeing some of the products of that system in your budget notebooks that you've been getting at all agencies.
Other questions for Mr. Rocco? Thank you very much, Ken.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Rocco, the same question I guess that I asked Mr. Chamoff is that having observed your office through two sessions, see a fair amount of what at least I perceive as duplicative requests or members strolling in asking you to research terribly complex areas, given the limited amount of people that you have and the substantial responsibilities. Are there recommendations that you can make to the legislature to help streamline your processes reduce access to your staff outside of Ways and Means folks? I mean, I'm grasping here to try to figure out, is there a way to make your burden lighter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think one area that we would like to look at is the development of fiscal impact statements, because there's a certain period during sessions where committees have to have a hearing on a bill to keep it alive, basically. And in those cases, we are sometimes overpowered by the number of requests that we get for fiscal impact statements. So if there was a way to have a better understanding of which bills committee chairs would like to, that are serious about going forward and need fiscal information, I think that would help us. And we try to get that information, but because of the time crunch, a lot of times it's not possible to get a detailed list of what they're actually looking at moving ahead.
And who is the gatekeeper in that process?
Mr. Chair, the gatekeeper is... I don't think there is a gatekeeper.
Would it be helpful to... do as Representative Johnson is requesting, and that is that maybe there ought to be some better oversight with a gatekeeper, perhaps not committee, but we do have a committee already formed, and the co-chair is there a...
Well, Mr. Chair, the fiscal impact process is separate from that whole Ways and Means process up front. Eventually, bills that do have a significant fiscal impact come to Ways and Means, but it's basically the need of a committee to have fiscal information so that they can make changes to a bill or understand why a bill costs.
What we're saying, though, is it eventually goes back between the Senate and the House to about 20 different people who are committee chairs that could come in and say, this is an important bill to our committee to run a fiscal on.
Yes. That would be helpful. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator, Representative Johnson.
I guess with the caveat that I would like to make sure that, I don't know how to say this any other way, that partisan sensitivities are at least acknowledged. I don't have a solution right now, but some way to make it a little bit easier for you to manage the volume of requests that you're getting. And I just... feel compelled to say that.
Mr. Chair, there was one other thing that we did during the interim that was that has some potential of relieving emergency board workload, and that was we moved to consent type approach on grant applications and reports, non-controversial reports to the emergency board. That seemed to work very well. And I think we're looking at, with leadership's approval, of continuing that approach.
Representative Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just am concerned. I looked at Ken's challenges. I'm concerned with the major IT initiatives that we're going to have during the upcoming, that I think we're going to have during the upcoming interim, as well as on an ongoing basis, that we lack the correct LFO staff to be able to do that. I think... my concern is, and since, Mr. Chair, you have both the gas IRMD budgets and the LFO budgets in this committee, I'm concerned with the lack of work that DAS has done to try and help us move some of these policy issues and get our arms around it, that we may want to look at borrowing some money from DAS IRMD to fund a IT person within LFO, since the state spends over $1 billion in that particular area of the budget. Suggest that to you, Mr. Chair, as we move forward, that we find somewhere else to get that money from one of the agencies in order to achieve the policy and operational efficiencies that we need to achieve.
Ken? Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, we have discussed internally ways of giving better service to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, because you're correct, we do not have that expertise. In the last interim, early on, we had entertained getting on contract some services to provide that technological review. ended up working closer with IRMD to provide those services, but that is something that we could use some more assistance with.
Thank you. Further questions for legislative assistance, Mr. Rocco? Thank you very much, Ken. Appreciate it. And then we've got legislative revenue, Paul Warner. Just in time, Paul. Paul, we're running on a schedule here. I'm not sure whether we may have to carry Karen over to tomorrow for Commission on Indian Services.
Okay.
But we'll and we do have a work session coming up at 10:30 on Senate Bill 258, so we'll need to kind of pump it real through in a hurry here, Paul, if we could.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I've also asked our House Revenue Chair Shetterly to drop by, and so he may appear here on the scene shortly. I have prepared a summary document for you that summarizes our notebook packet and kind of highlights some of the things that's happened over the last biennium and some of the things we anticipate in the coming biennium. First of all, just to remind you of what our basic mission is, and that is to provide objective, unbiased research and analysis on revenue issues. Of course, we staff both the House and Senate revenue committees, and we do deal a lot with the public, particularly in the interim, especially on initiatives that come up. We do prepare revenue impact statements, and we review, I think it's about 5,000 bills per, or 5,000 revenue statements per year, either amendments or bills per session. We do prepare research reports on initiatives and major public finance issues. This is one of our primary activities during the interim, is to prepare as much as we can in anticipation of issues that will be before you in the coming session. And also we staff the interim committees. We typically do have a House and Senate interim revenue committees. We are work with designated task forces, work groups, and so forth during the interim. Our statutory authority is really 173.8, which spells out the duties of the Legislative Revenue Officer. Our agency description, we have six permanent staff. Myself, I'm including as an economist, with four other staff economists and our office manager, Kim James. The Legislative Revenue Office, we're funded entirely by general fund revenue. We do specialize in areas that you're all familiar with, overall public finance, and, of course, things that emerge as issues oftentimes are not things we anticipate that become major revenue issues. Personal and corporate income taxes, of course, we maintain a model of the personal income taxpayers, our so-called tax calculator. That's about 50,000, a sample of about 50,000 taxpayers, and we can run any kind of simulations that for policy purposes. We spend a lot of time with property taxes. I've put consumption taxes in there. Remind you that we're really looking at the general kinds of consumption taxes, like a retail sales tax, and we do follow that closely. For example, we've been following closely the streamlined sales tax legislation for potential implications for us in Oregon. And we also include excise taxes, things like transportation finance fits in that, the gasoline tax, weight mile tax, for example. We spend a lot of time with school finance on distribution of the state school fund, a lot of requests from individual districts. I'll often go and to individual districts and talk to school boards, for example, and what our runs show in terms of the revenue situation. We do also analyze economic effects of tax changes and distribution of the tax burden, and we've developed our Oregon tax incidence model to help us do that. It's on the back side of this page. One thing kind of interesting about our agency history, we were created in 1975, the 75 legislature, and at that time we had five staff economists and an office manager. Kim tells me I'm not exactly correct in saying we've stayed at that same size. We did have some more clerical staff in the early 80s, but we are the same size now as we were in 1975 when we were created. We do get, during the session, we get The Assembly provides us with session clerical staff. We have three positions we use during the session. 0103 activities, many of those activities were related, of course, to the special sessions. We did have an interim House Revenue Committee, and we did have an interim Senate Budget Committee that we staffed. The two things that I would refer to here that were kind of the costs of the special session from our sense. I've asked Chair Shetterly that the appointing authority for my position is our Revenue Committee chairs. So it's Chair Shetterly and Chair Deckard are the appointing authority in statute for the office.
Chair Shetterly.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23, and also I'm privileged to be serving this session as chair of the House Revenue Committee, as I served last session and through the interim as well, speaking in support of the Revenue Office budget and anything that you can do. I think that if you look at the constitutional obligation of the legislature, it is very specific. Our principal, primary, preeminent constitutional obligation is to craft a balanced budget for the state every 2 years. You're very familiar with the one driver in that process being legislative fiscal office. And of course, the other driver in that process is legislative revenue. So if you want to pare this down to the two most essential offices to what is our primary constitutional charge, it is a fully functioning legislative revenue and legislative fiscal office. Clearly, without the work of the Revenue Committee, we don't get the work we need during session on the revenue impacts, and you know as members how important it is that we have staff sufficient to produce those revenue impact statements and reviews of bills on a timely basis. During the interim, of course, that's when we do all of our work to prepare the legislative revenue agenda. In the last interim, we did, for instance, a Herculean effort not only on the special session agendas, but also efforts relative to school funding and accountability. And these are works that we would just cannot fulfill our constitutional obligation without. And so Paul has all the particulars on that, and I'll let him address the just specifically what the office does. But I guess my point to you would be that in terms of our ability to discharge our principal constitutional function, the two main offices that we have that serve that for us are the revenue and fiscal office, and it'd be difficult to see us achieving our constitutional responsibility without a fully staffed and functioning office on both sides.
Thank you. Questions for Chair Shetterly? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Paul, appreciate your being here and for your testimony.
I'm way down in this part of the building.
Are there, Paul, I'm going to interrupt you there. Appreciate your the handout. Are there questions that we need to ask Paul before we move on to the next item on our agenda?
I just have a quick question for
Please.
Staff. I'm interested to know what Paul's office looks like versus the state economist and how many staff Nats has over there doing the same kind of job that we've got doing over here, and maybe take a look at where we're at in terms of those types of things, if we have to look for shifts or fines in the legislative budget, because I think DAS, based on their budget, has a boatload of people comparatively, and if we're going to right-size who's doing what in government and the balance of power, I think that that's some place we can look.
As the former state economist, Paul shares a lot of those responsibilities, but none of the culpability relative to the...
How many people are over there, Paul?
President Patterson, Mr. Chair, there's...
You have to answer that question. I don't want you to throw people under the bus. But
I think they have about five FTE. You know, they're pretty much a similar size, but they have taken on responsibilities. The inmate forecasting, for example, is a function they have. Demographic forecast. So their cost allocation, highway cost allocation study. So they've done some things that they didn't do, for example, when I got there in 1989.
They also have Department of Revenue, too.
Right.
And we do too, but Representative Patrick, they are a big help to us.
There are some shared responsibilities. I think that's a very valid comment that we probably ought to just take a quick look at some of those.
We'll have a state economist as well as DOR.
We'll have staff look at those two issues. Paul, thank you very much. We are going to go ahead and continue on here. Okay. Colleagues, we'll close the public hearing portion on Senate Bill 5528, and we'll open a public hearing, and I guess we don't go to public hearing on this. We'll just go straight into work session. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 258A. Dallas?
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 258A is one of the PERS bills that was in the co-chair's budget. It allows vested members to withdraw account balances at 150% of their member account balances. They have to make those withdrawals in that election between July 1st, 2004 and June 30th, 2006. The estimated savings to the program are that when these people take their cash out, it's 150% of their balance, but they would not then be entitled to any retirement benefits, and so you exclude the employer's money match contributions, also any COLAs and the like. So there's an estimated actuarial savings and a savings to employer rates as a result. You have the fiscal in front of you. You have the staff measure summary. It came out of Senate General Government Subcommittee, and it's scheduled for full in an hour.
Just one quick question, Dallas, and taking a look at the PERS expenditures, 2003-2005, what's your anticipation there?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is based on the fiscal that they've provided us. Staff is recommending no provision be provided now that because of the delayed implementation date and other bills that are coming forward, I think the emergency board can deal with this later on in the interim.
You've heard the recommendation of legislative fiscal. Questions? And seeing none, are there any objections to passing Senate Bill 258A to the full with two-pass recommendations? Representative Patrick so moves. Further discussion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Okay.
Let's see. Is someone invested in it in the full ways and means?
No.
Okay. I can do it on the ERS committee.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. And the Senate, your presence is requested on the floor.
Yes, I know.
Okay. So, colleagues, we will close in the public hearing on the work session on Senate Bill 258A. And
Mr. Chair, before Dallas leaves.
Dallas?
Dallas might be the wrong person to ask, but if we're going to do full at 11:30, our notice is already into the...
Yeah, she has notified the guests.
Good, to get us excused.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Colleagues, the Senate is under call. I appreciate the Commission on Internet Services waiting patiently. Karen, Justin, thank you very much for waiting. We're going to go ahead and carry over in order to make sure that we've got Senate here tomorrow to be able to hear the Commission's presentation. So we're going to carry over Senate Bill 55, and I probably ought to open back up public hearing on Senate Bill 5528, and we'll carry over item number 6, the Commission on Indian Services, where Karen and Justin can come back and make a presentation with the Senate Commission. With that, we will go ahead and close then Senate Bill 5528 public hearing and adjourn until tomorrow at even time. Thank you very much.
Why does this bill make any sense?